Welcome to Creative Conversations. I'm Roger Humphrey. In this episode, I'm pleased to welcome author, columnist, and podcaster, Jeff Giles. Please join us as we talk about his newest book, writing, music, podcasting, and much, much more. Before we begin, please hit the like and subscribe buttons. It's easy, free, and it really helps me out a lot. Thanks. And we are welcoming to the show Jeff Giles. Jeff, hi, thank you.
Thank you for making room for me. Appreciate it. I'm happy to be here.
Yeah, this will be a lot of fun. I have to say, right out of the chute here, that I went to your bio and was looking at stuff, and I read the first chapter of your book, which you have published online, and immediately went to Amazon and bought it.
I love that. Thank you.
So yeah, it's what a unique story. What a unique book. I can't wait to get it here so I can just start chewing into it hard and fast. It just looks like such an original story. The Langley Powell and the Society for the Defense of the Mundane. I got that right?
You've got it 100% correct, yes.
Boy, there's a lot of syllables in that. So first off, tell me about the story, pretty please.
Okay, yeah. It is a supernatural comedy about a world-renowned debunker of paranormal phenomena who dies in a freak accident and is very embarrassed and annoyed to discover that he has become a ghost.
Yeah, I can see where that could be inconvenient.
It upends everything he thought he knew about the universe, and it's just the start of a series of what he regards as sort of rude jokes on his at his expense by the universe, and he does actually find out that the universe has a sense of humor, and early on he encounters Albert Einstein, who tells him that if you've ever felt like it's just one of those days when everything's out to get you, that's probably the case. It's the universe having a few laughs at your expense.
I love that. I love it. That's funny. One of the things that caught my eye, it kind of set you up for, okay, you know, you're in for a kind of an interesting ride right off the bat, are the names of the characters.
Yes.
Neville Pemberton and Orson Mead. I mean, these are great names. Were you up like all night thinking of these things, or did you just have bad pizza, or what was going on there?
Langley's first name came to me because when I was a kid, my mother was a big viewer of ABC soap operas, and there was a character on All My Children named Langley. I can't even remember his last name now, but he was kind of a stuffy guy, and so that, I guess, that popped into my head for that reason. Orson Mead, that name just popped into my head. I don't know why or how. And then I think with Neville, I may have done a little bit of research there to figure out popular names at the time that that character was born.
Got it. Okay. So, but yeah, I'm just looking. I'm saying, okay, there's no Larry.
There's no Larry. No.
There's no Jerry.
There's a Frank.
So too fun. Too much fun. I love that, and I love that so much. So when did the book first come out?
It was released in July through Humorist Books. That was after I spent several years trying to find a literary agent. I think if you've talked to any amount of authors on your show, you probably have heard this or variation of the story many times. The agents are tough to find. And ultimately, what it came down to was Humorist had an open submission period for manuscripts, and I sent it in, and they liked it enough to put it out.
That's awesome. That's awesome. So some of the people that I've had that are successful authors in their own way, depending on how you define success. I think that that's, but they are successful, consider themselves successful, and they're self-published. And so I didn't know if you'd kind of gone that route or had taken a look at that.
I have done that in the past. The first book that I published was actually, to go back to ABC daytime dramas, the first book that I published was an oral history of the show One Life to Live. And that I self-published. And I had a good experience with that. But I think it's probably a little easier to say that if you have put something out that is hyper-targeted at a very niche audience. You know, if you release a book about a television show, you kind of know who you're marketing to, and it's pretty easy to find them. For fiction, it's a little bit of a different story. And I also felt like this book had a pretty solid hook. I think the elevator pitch is attention getting, and I just felt like it was sellable, and I wanted to give it my best shot. To at least say that I tried to find a publisher for it. But I don't think there's anything wrong with self-publishing at all.
The world has changed so much, and it's certainly post-pandemic, but even prior to that, little boutique publishing houses and recording labels and such that were kind of frowned upon at one point. You know, if you didn't have a major publishing deal with a major company or a major recording contract with a major company, a major label, people kind of look down their nose on you. But boy, that's changed a lot. It's changed a lot over the last 20 or 30 years, I think. But boy, certainly post-pandemic, I think.
I agree with that completely. And I think something that people don't really, I think something that a lot of people don't really understand is that the amount of money that creatives stand to gain through this type of endeavor has decreased significantly over the period of time that you're talking about. And so if you're going to, I don't know, I think the stereotypical kind of vision of this life is that you sign the contract and then all your problems are solved and the company comes along and they do everything for you and you make a bunch of money and happily ever after. And these days, I think even major book publishers expect authors to come up with their own marketing plan or to have a big social media footprint to make things that much easier for the company. And in the end, you probably aren't going to get any big checks coming your way anyway. So if you're going to self-publish and get, 100% of not very much, as opposed to signing a deal with a publisher and getting a percentage of not very much, then there's probably nothing
Yeah,
wrong with that.
and particularly if you have to do most of the heavy lifting. The one thing that the big companies do have is they do have some distribution advantages that you don't have on your own. But I know that when I was a kid and still had hair on my head, a struggling musician, major labels. Boy, they would sign you and they didn't know anything about you. Nobody knew anything about you, and they would take you under their wing and they would pump a ton of money into you. Of course, they'd get it all back, you know, because they were the first creditor that was paid.
The
But
magic of recouping,
yeah, but and often more than once. But that said, they could get you into radio stations all over the country that you couldn't do on your own or could barely do on your own and things like that. Today they talk to you, and it's you know, if you don't already have a big following, if you're not already doing some serious business on your own, they're really not interested. You know, and I'm assuming that book publishing is probably a parallel story.
I think in some ways it is. There is another Jeff Giles who used to write for Entertainment Weekly and Time Magazine. And he and I used to get each other's mail sometimes. We're fairly friendly. And when he left Entertainment Weekly to write a novel, he told me at one point that his publisher was upset that he was not me on Twitter because I had more followers than he did. So even at that level, they want you to be well positioned as, you know, a delivery mechanism for promotion. And I think the music industry is an apt comparison. That's my background, is writing about music and making music. And when I was releasing, when I started releasing records, that was back when you still had to have physical distribution. And it was a huge hill to climb. If you didn't have physical distribution, then you might as well just flush your money down the toilet.
Right.
And then digital distribution came along, which knocked down a lot of that gatekeeping, but it also increased just the sheer amount of, I hate to use the word, but product on the market. And in order to cut through all that extra noise, you have to be, I think, incredibly lucky more than anything else.
Yeah, I've commented on numerous occasions to anybody who will listen that that in today the good news is that anybody can put music out on out online. The bad news is today anybody can put music out online. And so you're right, there's just a lot of stuff out there. And I decided. Well, I'm a classical guitarist, so I mean, you're talking niche right off the bat, and you know, and you got a lot of people out there looking for a very small audience, and I don't think anybody in my business ever envisions themselves following in the footsteps of Taylor Swift, for example, or somebody like that. I mean, you're just, you know, you're not gonna, it's just not gonna happen. So it's a different business. Entirely. But at the same time, there's certain things that you have to do that are the same. And I think in publishing, it's got to be the same thing that I had an author on here recently, and she's a first time author, and she wrote a children's book. And you know, she is absolutely not competing with John Grisham. I mean, and I don't think there's any expectation on her part of that being a situation. So I think we have our own markets, and yeah, children's market is a nice market, but it's a niche. It's like classical guitar. Gee, can you say obscure? And so yeah,
I think
it's a different business.
the dream is just to use your talent to generate enough passive income to pay the bills, right? That shouldn't.
We're all just trying to put cornflakes on our bowl, right? So,
Exactly. You don't need to compete with John Grisham. It's just that I would love to think that this will be sorted out eventually. I think it has to be, otherwise nobody's gonna go into this business anymore. Somebody has to figure out a way to heal the massive divide between the countless people at the, I don't want to call it the bottom, but the countless people who are putting things out and really not making any money at all, and then the handful of people who are making a decent living at this. There should be a middle ground.
And of course, the wild card now that you and I both face this one is artificial intelligence, right? You know, so.
I mean, I don't know if you, I hear, I think just the other day on Spotify, I heard some AI music. It's getting very, it's getting very, I don't want to say good, but the hard to tell. It's getting very
Well,
automated.
sophisticated.
Yeah,
Yeah,
sophisticated is a good word for it.
the techniques are becoming more and more sophisticated, but I don't think the quality of music's getting any better. You know, and
I
I
don't
think
really know how it's made. I know there are people like, there's an account that I follow on Instagram called Obscurist Vinyl, and they just for comedy, they will produce kind of rudely profane songs that are done in styles of bygone eras. So, you know, it sounds like an old blues song, but the lyrics are absolutely not anything that you would have heard in the 50s. And I don't know how they make those things, but it's I think it's kind of like with text. If there's somebody there at the wheel and they're using the technology to bring their ideas to life rather than just pressing a button and seeing what happens, then you can get something passable. But I don't know, I still don't like it very much.
I'm constantly running into things about articles, if I may, about how you can make good money using AI to write a book in a day, and you know, and all that kind of stuff. And I'm thinking, yeah, well, that's cringeworthy for me. I mean, I just you know, I think that's probably this podcast is a little bit of a middle finger to that whole thought process. And in my particular, well, I don't perform anymore, but in sense of music, at least we have live performance that we can, although that's not what it was, but at least, you know, we can go out there and shake the tree a little bit, you know, but you can only do so many book readings.
I think ultimately, and maybe this is naive, maybe this is just because I'm old, but I think that ultimately people will always snap back to a desire for a human connection. I think you're seeing it now with the way people are abandoning what used to be called Twitter. Not just because the guy who owns it is a maniac, but because the it stopped working the way it was supposed to. It became harder to interact with people, to have conversations with people. And now they're flocking to Blue Sky, which feels a lot like Twitter used to. And I think that there's a hunger for that. I see it also with editorial destinations on the web. Using the internet used to be a lot more fun, and then it kind of got taken over by tech giants, social media, and those things. With algorithmically defined feeds, replaced daily destinations for articles that would amuse us, or forums where you can meet people like you. All that kind of got swept away over the last 15 years. And I think people are remembering that the way the web works now, or kind of doesn't work now, it wasn't always that way, and it doesn't have to be that way. So I think eventually, my hope is that this technology will be put in its place. I don't know.
Well, I know that I miss the days of opening up a newspaper and discovering an article that I wasn't looking for,
Yes.
or tripping over a recipe that I didn't know that I had to have, or you know, something like that. Where with the internet now, it's all algorithm, and so you know, the perfect example for everyone is, you know, you buy a pair of shoes online, and the next thing you know, you're getting ads from 15 different places on, you know, hundreds of more shoes that you have to have. And it's like, dude, I only needed the one pair and I already bought them, you know. Thanks for the interest.
Absolutely agree.
And so it's, yeah, it's pretty bad. So now you write about culture anyway, right? In other forums.
I do. Yeah, I've been doing it for a very long time, and I continue to.
Now, is this a freelancer or is a staff writer? Or
I
both?
have done both. Currently, I'm just doing it for me. One thing, and maybe this ties in somehow to conversations that you've had with other writers, but I have found in the past that writing about that if I turn culture writing into a full-time job, that it increases the risk of burnout. And it also, I think most of the jobs in that sphere require you to operate in a model that prioritizes volume over voice, let's say. And there were many years when this may sound overly precious, but there were many years when I wondered whether by doing what I considered to be hack work for money, I was running the risk of smothering the muse. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I do. I do. I wrote a blog before I started doing the podcast. I wrote a blog for a couple of years, and I was posting twice a week, and just about whatever. And I found after about 3 years that I was descending into whining. Oh, woe was me, and this really sucks. And so I stopped.
I can
But
empathize with that.
I think living in a bubble like I do here, it's that's boy, that's an easy trap to fall into. So that's it's nice to talk to other people.
Currently, I try to post daily. I don't always, but I try to, and it's a lot of that is because I feel like I'm thinking, are you familiar? Do you know who Jerry Douglas is? Since you play.
No, I'm sorry.
Jerry Douglas, he's a bluegrass
Oh
musician.
yeah, right. I know who he is.
Once I interviewed him and I asked him about his practice routine, and he said something to the effect of that at his age, he had to practice every day just to make sure that the roads and bridges were still connected. That has a lot to do with why I try to post something every day, not thinking too heavily about it, not editing it, just doing it to make sure that the machinery is still, running smoothly, so that when I do want to write something that I consider to be more important, I don't have to flush any rust out of the pipes.
The chops are still there.
But the risk of descending into whining or burning out is always there. You have to kind of be sensitive enough to know what you need that day.
Podcaster also.
I am. I co-host a show called The Record Player with a guy named Matt Wardlaw, and the gimmick there is that every guest is asked to pick a favorite album that they come to discuss, and we start the show talking about that, and then we segue into the discussion about whatever they're there to promote. And the idea there, and maybe you can empathize with this to an extent, is that having been on both sides of the interviewer interviewee divide, I know it can be a nerve-wracking experience whether you're conducting the interview or you're being interviewed. And the thought was that if we just have people show up and start talking about something that they love as opposed to something that they're trying to sell,
Oh, you're right.
it feels more informal, it builds a rapport, and you can have a better conversation that way. So yeah, record player.
And you do largely entire albums as opposed to like doing a single or this, right?
Yeah, I'm an album kind of guy. And
I think you will appreciate this story. I have a I still have a handful of students and that I annoy every week. And I this young man who's a senior in high school, he's been with me since probably first grade. He's been with me forever. Plays solo guitar, classical guitar, and other things. Plays, finger style as well. And we were talking about this, but he a few weeks ago was watching a TV show and he heard a Simon and Garfunkel song. And so he went from that to listening, I don't know if he went on Spotify or bought the album or what, but he listened to Bookends front to back and he fell in love with the song Old Friends. And so I ended up doing an arrangement for him of Old Friends for solo guitar. But the idea that you take a kid that's 17 years old or 18 years old will sit and listen front to back to an album, which is something when those albums came out and I was a young man. And such. We had listening parties. We get people together, Have you heard, Are You Experienced? You got to check this out, or Abbey Road, or and we would get together with these albums and we would sit down and listen to them the way people watch a movie today. And of course, and bathroom break came when you had to pick the thing up and turn it over. So, wait a minute, be right back.
Absolutely. And again, I think it's kind of a double-edged sword because I've seen it with my children. They're much more educated listeners than I was at their age, and that's because they have access to what Spotify wants you to believe is, you know, close to the entirety of recorded music history. We know it's really not that. It's just a fraction of it, but they have access to almost anything they could think to want to hear, and that leads younger listeners, I think, to you know, there's no barrier there. If a kid that you're talking to wants to hear Simon and Garfunkel, they can. And but I think that the flip side of that is that the sheer volume of stuff that's available makes it more difficult to really settle in with a piece of music. I mean,
Right.
I came up with cassettes and vinyl, and I loved coming home from the store with the thing in my hand, unwrapping it, and looking at the liner notes while I was listening to it.
Oh, yeah, that was half the fun.
That was half the fun. You find out who played on it. You get familiar with the session players of the era. You read the lyrics. You really, it, I think that way, the music really has a chance to just seep into your DNA. And I find it very hard to listen with that level of focus and attention now. And I think there are many younger listeners who don't even know that kind of listening even exists.
Well, there was a vibe to the music then that you don't get today. If it was an California group or something like that, you had the Wrecking Crew that was in the room with them, creating that stuff, or some of the guys in Muscle Shoals, and you get
Yes.
that vibe, or you get the Detroit vibe, or you get, and these session musicians, these guys played sessions all day, every day with themselves. And it was just they plug in a new artist, they crank out another hit record or two. And so they knew they were such a well-oiled machinery, but they had their own vibe, they had their own shorthand, musical shorthand and things that they did. And they would create a sound in that studio that was desirable. Today, they're sitting at their computer, and they're cranking out loops. And I'm not saying that that's necessarily bad, but you don't have the same vibe by a long shot.
I agree with that. I think I don't want to come across as I never want to be the guy who says that music was better when I was younger. Everybody feels that way, but I think that has more to do with being young than it has to do with the actual state of music. But yeah, absolutely. And this is the other side of that double-sided blade, is that session musicians aren't really a thing anymore, at least outside of Nashville. Nobody needs them because you don't have to use a studio. And I do think you lose something there. I think when I was young, if you saw the label of the record company on the album artwork, you kind of knew the kind of thing that you were going to get. The Columbia was different from Warner Brothers, was different from Atlantic, and so on and so forth. And those Even those corporate identities have sort of evaporated in the era of mergers and acquisitions.
Yeah, I think you're right. And I agree with you on not wanting to say one is better than the other. I just I actually had I was I did an interview years and years and years ago, and the interviewer her gotcha question, which is funny, but she said, so and I'm a classical guy, so she says, so what do you think is the best music in the world? And I said, oh, well, that's easy. And her jaw dropped. And I said, it's the music you graduated from high school on. Right?
Oh yeah,
Because
I mean, that's what is it? Studies have shown, right? 15, 16, that's really when that's your sweet spot.
But you think of all the things that you go through between the ages of 13 and the ages of 21 or 22 when you graduate from college and so on. That stretch of 8 to 10 years in there. And everything that you go through, and that music's in the background, and so yeah, your heart was broken there, you had your first kiss there, all in all,
That's right.
and so yeah, it's but yeah, what's the best music in the world? Please. So, and I remember my parents' friends saying, how awful the Beatles were, so It goes on and on and on and on and on. The fact that I don't get it doesn't mean it's not good. It just means I don't get it. So,
That's right.
well, Jeff, believe it or not, we're out of time, my friend. I've so enjoyed this conversation. We'll have to, let's do it again.
I would love to. Thank you
Me
for having
too,
me.
me too. So, but thank you right now. I'll talk to you later. Bye-bye.
I want to thank Jeff for taking time to come on the show. I can't wait to read his book. If you would like to get a copy for yourself or for a friend, there's a link in the description below. Oh, by the way, did you know that there's also a weekly blog that I write that will give you updates on all of my guests? Just go to www.rogerhumphrey.com and then click the blog tab at the top of the page. And please subscribe. I promise, no spam. Thank you again for stopping by. If you enjoy these podcasts, please tell your friends and come back real soon to Creative Conversations with Roger Humphrey.